You are listening to Pacifica Radio's national coverage of the final presidential debate. My name is Mark Rabawi, and first we're going to go to Robert Knight, Pacifica Radio's national correspondent, who has been with us for all of these debates. And Robert, we'll go to you with your thoughts on what you heard today.
Well, Mark, tonight's debate struggled under a logically non-rigorous outline designed with as many holes, redundancies, overlaps, and omissions as an elementary school civics term paper that was hastily written the night before it was due. Which is odd, really, because debate moderator Bob Schieffer actually wrote it 10 days ago. The agenda included such precise talking points as America's role in the world, our longest war, Afghanistan and Pakistan, and channeling the Israeli Prime Minister, red lines, Israel and Iran. There was the changing Middle East and new face of terrorism, parts one and two, and finally the rise of China and tomorrow's world. And throughout this morass, we learned that there were a few significant foreign policy differences between the two Republican and Democratic candidates, Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. Both supported an international policy of drone strikes from above controlled by bases from afar. Both averred the placement of U.S. troops in the opportunistic petroleum-rich targets of regime change. Both endorsed extrajudicial assassinations. Both scrambled to be Israel's best friend and Iran's worst enemy, and both exhibited an appalling equivocation when condemning Iran's, as they put the term so many times, Iran's nuclear program. They seldom, if ever, distinguished between Iran's International Atomic Energy Agency-approved civilian nuclear power program and a weapons program to develop a nuclear bomb or even having enough fuel and processors to do that. Both agreed that Assad has to go in Syria, but did not specify any rational mechanism for the post-coup chaos soon to be fomented by the U.S. covert arming of Libyan and other jihadis in Syria with the aid of Saudi Arabia, Qatar and Turkey and NATO. They are now said to be armed with as many as 20,000 shoulder-fired missiles. There were some cavils. Romney touted Obama's quote that al-Qaeda, which was renewed after the Libyan coup, was, quote, on the run, end quote. Romney wanted to keep more troops in Iraq than Obama, even though Obama had no choice based on hardball negotiations from the new Shia-centric regime installed in Baghdad. No serious mention was made of the United States military presence that continues in Iraq under the guise of trainers and the thousands of privatized security personnel there. There was moderate disputation over the Benghazi incident, but no analytic review of whether the new nation of militias and racist anti-African purges inside Libya was in fact a better thing. Instead, the astonishing statement was made at one point that Muammar Gaddafi had more American blood on his hands than anyone but Osama bin Laden. There was also scant specificity about the long-term multi-trillion-dollar cost of the American wars abroad. And finally, an entire quintile of debate was given to one nation, China, but nothing of significance about the entire continent of Africa, whose resources and politics will eventually redefine international relations later on in this 21st century. And all in all, if we had to grade tonight's grade school civics term paper, it would get a D for the non-insightful analysis, and the student would have to do independent reading to learn anything useful or substantially true about so-called international affairs. Mark?
Robert Knight, Pacifica Radio's national correspondent, thanks so much for joining us. And of course, for people who have access to the archives, you can hear Robert's thoughts on all of the previous debates. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's national coverage. The final presidential debate just concluded. Thank to you to Michael Yoshida, Dan Ross, John L. Mele, and Doyle Odom for engineering the show. Producer is Otis McClay. My name is Mark Rabawi. Thanks for joining us.
And this is WBAI and Pacifica's continuing coverage of tonight's terminal presidential debate between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, ostensibly on the subject of foreign policy. We have quite a lineup of analysts for you tonight from across the country in regard to the content of tonight's debate, in which the general consensus so far seems to be that there was very little practical difference in the belligerent policies, the drone attacks, the assassinations, the budget, the many ways in which United States military supremacy is taking place around the world. And my name is Robert Knight. I'm WBAI's senior national correspondent and the anchor of 5 o'clock shadow. And we're very honored To be joined live at this time by John Glazer of the intrepid organization called Anti-War, antiwar.com, which constantly produces pithy and deeply insightful analyses of American warfare and its precursors and its consequences. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what is your top-of-the-head impression of tonight's so-called international policy debate?
Well, first of all, I think you're right. On every substantive issue, the two candidates have very little to disagree about. And that should be, that should not be something that's encouraging to most Americans when they view this debate. On the previous debate, we saw, of course, Romney on the attack on issues of the economy. And this time, Romney was deferential to the president. He avoided confrontation. And the president tried to attack Romney on being all over the map. In effect, flip-flopping on various foreign policy issues, as he has done. Romney is very well known for having political positions which benefited him at the time, and then he'll go ahead and change them when it suits him later on. And that's what we saw in this debate. We saw a jostling between the two candidates, trying to quibble on issues of difference where they found them, but brought, by and large, in the broad scope of things, what we saw was two candidates agreeing on a foreign policy which is interventionist at its core, which aims at American dominance in the Middle East, which wants to support dictatorship around the world, which wants to foment war and the militarization of the conflict in Syria, which wants to stay in Afghanistan perhaps until 2024, although both candidates tried to claim that we would be out by 2014, and so on and so forth. They both agree on an aggressive, militaristic U.S. foreign policy, and that's what this debate was about.
John Glazer, earlier tonight in a different analysis, I referred to the outline of tonight's debate hosted by Bob Schieffer as being a poorly written elementary school civics term paper because of the omissions, the overlap, the non-rigorous outline that includes America's role in the world, our longest war, red lines, Israel and Iran, the changing Middle East, part one and part two, and the rise of China and tomorrow's world. Were you satisfied with the mechanics of the discussion, and do you think the host was adequate to preventing the discussion from leaking like a sieve?
Well, no. First of all, these debates, and many Americans don't understand this, but these debates are pre-planned and the topics are decided upon with the approval of both candidates of both parties. And that's a way to crowd out dissenting views. That's a way to make sure that questions are not asked, which really undercut both candidates' positions. For example, the drone war was mentioned. The drone war, of course, is the Obama administration's policy of bombing people from the sky with unmanned aerial vehicles, mainly in Pakistan and Yemen. These drone wars kill a large amount of civilians. Numerous academic studies now have come out to say that they terrorize civilians. The two UN investigators have called on the Obama administration to explain under what legal framework this drone war is justified, and suggested possibly that war crimes have been committed. But the only time that the drone war was mentioned in the entire debate was when Romney told, you know, how many tens of millions of Americans viewing the debate that he agreed with the Obama administration's policy of increasing the drone war in all of these different countries. Not mentioned was the fact that the drone war seems to be in direct violation of several domestic and international laws, and that it's killing reams of civilians. And in fact, the worst of it is that it is laying the groundwork for further blowback. It's increasing hatred of America in Pakistan and Yemen when people see that their neighbors and their villagers are killed. They desperately are motivated to take revenge, and we see that happening all over the place. None of that was mentioned. That was completely outside of the debate.
On the issue of international law, there was the mention by Mitt Romney that he would indict or cause to be prosecuted the Iranian Prime Minister Mahmoud Ahmadinejad for, quote, inciting genocide, end quote. Now, John Glazer, you are at Anti-War and at the website, antiwar.com, you've just published a comprehensive look at what we did or did not get in the debate titled Banished Issues, Five Things You Will Not Hear at Tonight's Debate. What do you think the major points of that are?
Well, one of them I mentioned is the drone war. The other that I mentioned, you just mentioned Ahmadinejad. That talk about Romney supporting an indictment of Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, under incitement of genocide, this is just crazy talk. It has nothing, it's not remotely situated with reality at all. Easily, U.S. presidents have more blood on their hands than Ahmadinejad. Iran hasn't invaded any country in centuries, contrary to what the U.S. has been doing. But Iran is another important issue that did not get brought up in the debate in the light that we would hope. For example, it was not mentioned that the consensus view of the entire intelligence community in the United States, according to the most recent national intelligence estimate, is that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program and that it has not made the decision to begin to develop nuclear weapons, which they're years away from, technologically speaking. So that was not mentioned. Not mentioned also was the sanctions regime that the Obama administration has placed on them. The sanctions were mentioned, but not mentioned was the fact that it's putting millions of lives at risk. The Charity Foundation for Special Diseases, which is a non-governmental medical organization in Iran that supports 6 million patients, said that the sanctions are preventing much-needed medicines from getting into Iran for diseases like hemophilia and multiple sclerosis and cancer, and it's driving the economy into the tubes, putting millions of lives at risk. That wasn't mentioned. Government secrecy and surveillance powers. Again, this is not mentioned, probably because both candidates completely agree. In 2011, the federal government spent $11 billion just on keeping secrets from the American public. None of that was mentioned because, of course, both candidates are going to lack this kind of transparency going forward. Aiding the Syrian rebels. This is another thing that wasn't mentioned. It was mentioned, but it was not properly put in context. I mean, not mentioned was the fact that these rebels, that the United States is currently cooperating with Saudi Arabia and Qatar to aid and arm. It wasn't mentioned that these rebels have committed war crimes and are increasingly seen from the U.S. intelligence community as fighting under the banner of Al-Qaeda. That's a very dangerous situation that has blowback written all over it, and that was not mentioned. One last thing, not mentioned, was that U.S.-backed Israeli crimes against the Palestinians are continuing unimpeded, and the military and economic and diplomatic support that the United States consistently gives to Israel literally enables Israel to steal more land, dispossess the Palestinians of their land and their homes. And the strictly imposed Israeli blockade on Gaza, which is violating international law, which prohibits collective punishment and creating a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, that was not mentioned either. These are the types of issues that we did not see. There's many, many more, but you can gather that since these candidates agree and since they can disregard any sorts of questions that they don't want brought up in the debate, we don't see these types of questions.
One other thing, John Glazer of Anti-War, I'm mightily concerned about the possibility of future actions against Iran, in particular with the nuclear refinement centers. I am given to understand that some of that is being displaced into a place called Fordo near the city of Qom that has in some way, because it is in a mountain and not so easily bombed, heightened and ratcheted up the agitation from the state of Israel in regard for there to be a military attack on Iran. Do you have an assessment on that?
Well, yes. So this Fordo complex, which enriches uranium, is inside Iran, and it is embedded inside the side of a mountain with reinforced concrete. It's done that way so that U.S. or Israeli bombs, primarily Israeli bombs, cannot destroy it upon impact. They did that knowingly because they know, the Iranians know, that the U.S. and Israel consistently threaten to strike at Iran's nuclear facilities. One thing I have to sort of reluctantly pat the Obama administration on the back for is having pressed back against the Israelis who for the last year or two have been pressuring for some sort of U.S.-backed strike on Iran. All the U.S. military assessments and military and intelligence assessments are in consensus that an attack on Iran would not be effective. It would be effective in rolling back the Iranian nuclear program only marginally and only temporarily. And the only thing that would possibly eliminate Iran's nuclear program and their capability would be an invasion. And a recent report by various military intelligence officials, former and current, including Brzezinski and Richard Armitage and many others, has said that that kind of intervention in Iran would be more costly than the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War put together.
John, thank you so much for the insightful analysis. John Glazer is with antiwar.com, and we commend your attention to your and your colleagues' fine work there.
Thanks so much.
This is WBAI and Pacifica's ongoing coverage of the postmortem of the terminal presidential debate. And my name is Robert Knight in New York, and we are now honored to be joined by Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report. He has a long history in political analysis, having been a co-founder of the Black Commentator and worked with America's Black Forum, among many other enterprises. And welcome, Glenn. What did you make of the debate tonight?
This is really getting into a kind of fantasy land. It's difficult for me to decide how one is supposed to judge or rate these debates, because there is very little light between these two people. And so if we're going to judge the debate, what's the criteria? Are we supposed to say who is the more effective imperialist? Are we supposed to root for or against the more effective imperialist? Obama has a superb imperial record, if that's what turns you on. Romney clearly is just a wannabe, but he does have aspirations. So how do we rate these people? I think one of the ways we look at it is that, I observe that Romney tells lies about what he says because he's a wannabe, and that is his record. His record is what he says. But Obama actually tells real lies about what he does and what he has done. For example, Obama claims that Romney wanted to leave troops in Iraq. That's what they were talking about this evening. And that he, Obama, did not. And that is a straight-up, bald-faced lie. And a lie that the corporate media lets him get away with, even though the evidence that it's a lie actually comes from the corporate media. Obama's operatives, and you could read it in the New York Times and the Washington Post and any other news outlet, up until literally about 2 weeks before the withdrawal deadline, the State Department and the Pentagon were diligently negotiating with the Iraqis, trying to get an extension on these troops. And the numbers of troops that they were throwing around was 10,000, the very number that Obama said Romney wanted to retain, and that he did not. But we know that that's exactly what he was doing. So it was just a bald lie. In fact, it's a lie, period, to say that Obama was an initiator of a pullout from Iraq. That's the result of an agreement between George Bush and the Iraqis. And the Iraqis held to the agreement, and the United States kept on trying to back out. In Afghanistan, they're having an argument really about nothing, nothing based on lies, mutual acceptance of a lie. That is, both say that they're quite okay with getting out, withdrawing from Afghanistan in 2014. But the United States is not going to withdraw from Afghanistan in 2014. There is no agreement to withdraw from Afghanistan in 2014. There's a strategic partnership agreement that has no number. We know that the administration keeps on talking about combat troops as opposed to support troops. That's a name change game that we saw him trying to pull in Iraq. And we know that the Pentagon is trying, it usually uses the number of 25,000 troops as the level of U.S. Involvement that it feels comfortable with. Understand, the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan when Obama was elected to office was only 34,000. And the Pentagon's now talking about 25,000. Most of these, it appears, from the operations they're talking about, are not support troops. They're killer special ops troops.
Trainers, as they're called. Trainers.
Yeah, right. Training. That's crazy. They're clearly designed for to conduct operations on their own. And as we look at the way the relationship between the Afghan military and the U.S. military is deteriorating, it is inconceivable that the United States would not have sufficient, what they call, force protection to protect any support troops that they actually had on hand. They're not going to let the Afghan military protect them. In terms of Libya, there was Obama bragging repeatedly about his attack on Libya. He said something that I think showed his lack of moral character, to put it very bluntly. He said that the United States stayed the course until Gaddafi was captured. I don't think Gaddafi was captured. I think I saw him, and so did you, executed with a knife up his butt. That he was savagely butchered as soon as they got their hands on him. But Obama brags that he was captured. There's something so morally offensive about hearing that come out of his mouth. I don't know, are we supposed to give him points or what on that? And Obama, in this Libya operation, actually invented his own new, novel, and extremely dangerous doctrine of war when he refused to allow the Congress to submit to the War Powers Act. He explained that the Libyan operation was not a war, and it was not a war because no Americans that the U.S. would reveal, that no Americans were killed. So this doctrine of war, out of this president's mouth, and never uttered by any other president that I can recall, is that the United States is only involved in warfare when U.S. Personnel are killed. But the United States can kill thousands of foreigners. It's still not a war, and it's not morally or legally anybody's business.
It's a frightening assertion of American supremacy reminiscent of another time in a prior century. We're speaking with Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report. And Glenn, I'm glad that you have culminated there on the issue of Libya, because I'm deeply troubled by the blowback, the consequences of this reckless coup, with all of its consequences, including the annihilation of towns of Afro-Libyans, of the roundups and tortures and extrajudicial deprivations of life, a confederacy of, if not dunces, a confederacy of militias that has no even remote claim to any of the attributes of nationhood.
I think we need to understand what Rubicon the United States has crossed with the advent of the Arab Spring. They've crossed the same Rubicon that they did long ago in Africa. In Africa, the United States policy has been that those regions that it cannot control directly, it will plunge into chaos. That's been the policy in Congo ever since Mobutu couldn't fulfill his historic mission. It's the U.S. policy in Somalia, quite clearly, and has been that way since 1990. So, and there are many other instances in Africa where the United States prefers chaos to if it can't directly control. But with the advent of the Arab Spring, that policy now was applied to North Africa and the Middle East. And so we have 1,700 militias in Libya, a nation of only 6 million people. That's a lot of militias. And fighting is still continuing. And what the United States seems quite satisfied with in terms of Syria is just the prolongation through their aggression and their proxy wars, the prolongation of chaos, not just in Syria, but throughout that part of the world, which plays absolutely wonderfully with Israel, who has always had a policy of seeking chaos and mayhem among all of the Arab countries that surround it. That is its strategic policy. The United States has entered into that phase in the Arab world, afraid that the consolidation of some new forces in the Arab world might be worse for it than the chaos they're fomenting now.
Well, Glenn Ford, I'd like you to stay on this particular point about the cascading catastrophe syndrome that the Libyan operation, which I think is going to be seminal for the better part of a century to come, that it has on other African states entirely. I was very much taken by the juvenile outline of tonight's debate that an entire quintile was devoted to China and not to Africa, to Egypt, to Somalia, all throughout the northern crown of Africa. And the resources and the appointment of a new leader of the Africa Command and so on. Can you give us the big picture there?
Let's talk facts about Africa and not the debate, because there was no disagreement on any major subject in this debate, and no disagreement really about China either. I found no area of any substantial disagreement. That's why to call it a debate, it seems more like a preening, an exercise in who can look more leader-like. But in terms of policy, if people think they're discerning significant policy differences here, I really question what they think. Significant, the meaning of the word significant is. In terms of the fallout from Libya, we predicted in Black Agenda Report before the United States and its allies declared victory. As I said, there's fighting going on all over Libya today. But we predicted that the whole of the Sahel and even further south, the Sahel region of Africa, would be set aflame. And since then, we saw what happened in Mali, and we've seen an increase, a very marked increase in the tensions in the Muslim north of Nigeria, and a general heating up of tensions, such that I think, you know, we're not getting very good coverage from these corporate media, and it's not just a matter of the bias of their coverage. They actually have very few people on the ground in Africa, so not much information from them is coming out of any kind. But the tension levels seem to be quite high in that whole northern tier, and in fact, it seems to have given pause to many of these countries. That is, the environment seems so fluid. Something very profound has happened in the wake of this attack on Libya, the rippling out of effects. And I think we'll see some very surprising to American eyes and ears developments there in the very near future.
Well, Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report, I thank you for the, as ever, astute global analysis. And we find ourselves today at a time when local tribalism or group interests may not actually be for the benefit of such groups if the international and wider world is put at a disadvantage. And that's why I so much admire the work that you and your colleagues do at Black Agenda Report, that continues. How can people follow you?
If black folks and progressives think that they have something to cheer about, in witnessing this so-called debate tonight between Romney and Obama, then they might as well cheer Romney, because there is no difference between these two characters. And if they believe that there is a difference, then they are suffering from some kind of clinical level of delusion, because any objective analysis of that so-called debate could find no basic disagreements. Not one. I challenge anyone to show me one basic policy disagreement here.
Well, Glenn Ford, it was great to see you at that wonderful event at Riverside recently celebrating the Black Agenda Report, and I congratulate you and everyone on your work over there, and advise our listeners to consider it at the website blackagendareport.com.
Now, we had great fun, and I think we'll have even better fun next year.
More to come. Thanks, Glenn.
Bye-bye.
I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is Pacifica WBAI continuing coverage of the terminal presidential debate earlier this evening. We are now joined live by Alice Slater, who is the New York director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. And she has also been working with the non-aligned movement of this planet Earth and is on the coordinating committee of Abolition 2000, a nuclear disarmament network. She has also been closely following developments in regard to the controversy over Iran and its civilian nuclear power program. Welcome, Alice. What did you think of the debate tonight?
I agree with your last speaker. It's Tweedledum and Tweedledee. I call them Republicrats and Demopublicans.
I have a name for them. I call them Demublicans.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one, too. Yeah. But anyway, I think Romney really shocked everybody. He just totally agreed with everything Obama said. But even on the earlier disagreements, it was just a matter of nuance and shading. I mean, there's nobody's talking about nuclear disarmament with Iran. I mean, Iran has taken a position. They were at a meeting just last month at the non-aligned meeting where they are now the chair. This is like 120 nations that it was formed during the Cold War to be a balance between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. So now there are 120 nations, and Iran just became chair. It rotates. And the meeting was in Tehran, and they called for the abolition of nuclear weapons by 2025 for a treaty. And this was actually a headline in the Washington Post, but it went totally unreported in the New York Times. They're burying this story, and it's crazy for us to tell Iran that they can't enrich uranium because they have a legal right to enrich uranium under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is a treaty that we signed in 1970 with five nuclear weapon states, the U.S., Russia, China, England, and France, promised to give up their nuclear weapons if nobody else would get them. And everybody signed this treaty except for three countries, Israel, Pakistan, and India, and they went and got nuclear weapons. But everyone else promised not to get them, and part of the deal was for not getting them, we would give them the keys to the bomb factory because we promised them so-called peaceful nuclear power. And what Iran is doing now, she is entitled to do under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is to enrich uranium.
Well, there's also the International Atomic Energy Agency, which has thus far certified the validity of the civilian nuclear energy program being pursued and developed in Iran. But can you take us, Alice Slater, into the difference between rhetoric, madness, and fact in terms of the IAEA and the wild and frightening tales told by politicians running for election?
Well, first of all, it's not wild to think that because Iran is enriching uranium, it will have a nuclear weapon someday. That is how every country gets its nuclear weapons, through this so-called peaceful nuclear power. So the first insanity is that we're spreading nuclear power around the world, because then we accuse people of proliferating. Now, Brazil is doing exactly what Iran is doing, but we're not telling Brazil not to enrich uranium. Japan does it, but we don't tell them not to. But anybody that does that has a capacity to make a nuclear weapon. What we really have to do is get the nuclear weapon states, starting with us, the United States, to give up our nuclear weapons. There are 20,000 nuclear weapons on the planet, and 19,000 of them are in the U.S. and Russia. All the other countries have 1,000 altogether. So it's up to the U.S. and Russia. And actually, it's the U.S. that's blocking this, because Gorbachev and Reagan met at Reykjavik. Gorbachev wanted to go to zero, but Reagan wouldn't give up Star Wars, so Gorbachev pulled the deal off the table. Then Putin asked Clinton to cut our arsenals to like 1,000 nuclear weapons each from the 20,000, but he said they won't make a deal if we put missiles in Poland and Romania, Czechoslovakia, and that's what we're doing. We're surrounding Russia with missiles. I mean, after we're putting them in former Soviet republics like Georgia, I mean, how would we feel if they did that to us? We know what happened when they put them in Cuba. I mean, the whole world almost went to war. And we're also putting missiles in Asia, threatening China. We're beefing up our troops in Australia with Japan. And Russia and China have been asking for a treaty to ban missiles and weapons in space. And we block it. So you've got this nutty military-industrial complex driving the arms race, telling us we have to be afraid of Russia and China when actually we're provoking them.
Alice, there's a series of events that has taken place recently in Iran, particularly during this summer and autumn. There was the Stuxnet virus,
exactly,
that is intended to sabotage machines that may or may not be involved in centrifuging and fuel refinement. At an address to the International Atomic Energy Agency in mid-September, the Iranian delegate revealed that a month before then that there had been a sabotage on the power lines leading to, I believe it was the Natanz plant at that time. And more recently, there is indicated that there has been some kind of electrical sabotage at another facility called Fordo near the city of Qom, where under a much more than normal fortified facility under a mountain or inside a mountain is where the centrifuging and development is reported to be continuing. And once again, within the rights and the dangers, as you so clearly specify, within the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. But here's a concern that is tempted by this circumstance. If it is a hardened facility inside a mountain, does that bring into any conceivable form of play? And I know this is a frightening and a remote possibility, but if it is more hardened than American bunker buster bombs, does that bring into play what is believed to be the 200 or 300 nuclear weapons possessed by Israel?
You know, any country, these nuclear weapons can be used. We use them on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Two bombs were dropped. That was it. Everybody's sitting there with their deterrent, but Israel knows that if they use it, somebody's going to bomb them. We don't use ours because we don't want to be bombed. These weapons are unusable. They're just like a kind of a leftover horror from the 20th century. We should be getting rid of them. That's how we should talk to Iran. And this Stuxnet computer virus, this is really dangerous for the United States to be doing this, because attacking somebody's systems with a computer virus is not difficult like a nuclear weapon. Anybody can do that. Any computer nerd can figure it out. And so we are leaving ourselves so vulnerable. Our electrical grid here, all our things that depend on computers. And that's another thing that Russia and China have asked us to negotiate a treaty to stop cyber war, and we're turning it down. We think we're going to get ahead. Same thing with these drones. I mean, these drones are terrible. The president is acting as judge, jury, executioner, picking targets on the ground, assassinating them, and killing civilians as well without any evidence or trial. And any country can do drones. These are like toy airplanes. I mean, we're leaving ourselves so vulnerable. The answer now is to start ratcheting down the violence and to definitely begin negotiations to get rid of the bomb. That's how you deal with Iran. And also, you phase out nuclear power. We don't need it. We have the sun, we have the wind, we have the tides. We have more sun and wind that falls on the earth than all the oil and gas and nuclear. And the only reason we have this filthy energy that's poisoning the planet is because these corporations can sell it. They can't sell the sun or the wind.
Well, Alice Slater, you have been a gust of fresh air in the obfuscated discussion about Iran and nuclear energy and development. And I congratulate you for your work at the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and with Abolition 2000 at the website abolition2000.org. How, in other ways, may people be aware of the brighter light that you bring to these issues?
Well, those are good websites to start with. And here in New York, we have a campaign to shut down Indian Point up on the Hudson. We're trying to get a resolution through the city council to make New York City go sustainable so we can be a light unto the world. If New York can do it, you know, if we can do it here, we'll do it anywhere. And that's how we handle Iran. We get rid of nuclear power and the bomb, and then we don't have to bomb other countries that we think are getting ahead of us.
Thank you once again, Alice Slater. See more of the work that she and the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation are doing at the website abolition2000.org. This is WBAI Pacifica ongoing coverage of the terminal presidential debate earlier this evening. And continuing on the thread of analysis, we are now joined live by the policy director of Just Foreign Policy, Robert Naiman. As with our other guests, yes, Robert, what were your first impressions of the so-called debate tonight?
Well, I was struck by the contradictions in what Governor Romney put out. On the one hand, he claimed, you know, oh, we don't want to do Iraq and Afghanistan anymore. On the other hand, he said he wants to make Iranian diplomats into pariahs. So that's the question. How are you going to resolve the conflict over Iran's nuclear program if you reject diplomacy? You know, you can't have, if you make Iranian diplomats pariahs, then presumably you can't negotiate with them. If you can't negotiate with them, then, you know, how are you going to get a deal on Iran's nuclear program? If you can't have a deal on Iran's nuclear program, then what's your plan for preventing a war? So it seemed very contradictory to me, and it wasn't the only contradiction. He also claimed that he wants to expand military spending. He wants to he demanded that the Pentagon prepare for fighting two wars. Which again, you know, it's a complete contradiction there. So I think he said peace six times in the debate. So he wants people to think that he's pro-peace. At the same time, he wants to expand military spending, prepare for two wars, and make Iranian diplomats into pariahs. So there was a deep contradiction in the rhetoric that he was putting out.
Well, if the diplomats of Iran are to be pariahs, it would only stand to reason, because it was also expressed his wish to have the president, Ahmadinejad, indicted, prosecuted, jailed, and executed by being a so-called war criminal and, fomenter of genocide.
Right. So this is the rhetoric that is reminiscent of the Bush neocon rhetoric about Iraq in the run-up to 2003. You know, this is a recipe for war if this became U.S. policy. And, of course, part of the context of this is a recent New York Times report that the, Obama administration officials are saying that they've got a preliminary agreement with Iranian officials to have direct bilateral talks with Iran on Iran's nuclear program after the election, which, if true, and apparently it is true, this is a very significant and positive development.
One of the things that was so prominent in the debate was the mutual affirmation of American executive imperial exceptionalism, of the ability, the right the prerogative to kill anyone on this planet at any time. We heard time and again during tonight's discussion words such as, we go after the bad guys and we kill them. You hear words of pretty much the same order out of both Romney and Obama in terms of the braggadocio of the murder of Muammar Gaddafi and Osama bin Laden and of the alternative to law and order on an international level, with the idea of indictments, arrests, prosecution, trial, and so on. Were you at all concerned by the new real politic of murder incorporated as foreign policy?
Well, unfortunately, the American exceptionalism, this is a constant of mainstream U.S. political debate. I thought it was positive that Bob Schieffer asked a question about drones. We had actually had a campaign, Just Foreign Policy, as well as a Brave New Foundation, Robert Greenwald. We had a campaign on Bob Schieffer to get him to ask a question about drones. So I thought that was positive that he at least said the word drone. I thought it was negative that he asked his question only of Romney. And I hope that Bob Schieffer is challenged on this, that journalists challenge Schieffer on this, because, you know, it's quite atypical to say, you know, I'm just going to ask a question of one guy. So I have to wonder what Schieffer's motivations were. Was it because he's, you know, afraid to ask President Obama about a program that the U.S. officially says is classified? The question and response with Romney, you know, showed the ridiculousness of that. Romney responded by saying, well, you know, we read about this program in the newspapers, and that's exactly true, which just points to the ridiculousness of the idea that the very existence of the program is classified, which remains to this day the official U.S. government policy. You know, when the ACLU filed a Freedom of Information Act request in 2010, and has sued the government in support of that request. And the Justice Department's position in the lawsuit is, you know, we're not going to talk about this because the program is classified. So that is really ridiculous. I was delighted that in front of a national television audience, Schieffer raised the question, but I was not delighted that he didn't also ask the question of Obama, and Obama didn't have to respond to it.
Well, apparently, Bob Schieffer argued with Ron Paul about the question of whether or not there is an angry reaction abroad by the targets of United States military actions, invasions, coups, overthrows, and assassinations that leads to jihadi resentment of the United States. This is in a discussion Schieffer had with Paul last year. And I guess to culminate the issue here, is there and building on that, what might be a better approach for, as you work so hard to evoke, a just foreign policy without the xenophobia, the obfuscation, and the innervation of emotions that are not healthy to survival or cooperation?
Well, I think a huge part of the story, you know, I don't think, for example, the U.S. drone strike policy in Pakistan that exists today would be possible if the lives of Pakistani civilians weren't being counted as zero. I mean, one of the most controversial things about the program is this question of civilian deaths and civilian casualties, which the U.S. government has not come clean on. We have reports from independent journalists like the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London that estimates somewhere between 400 and 800 Pakistani civilians killed since 2004 in U.S. drone strikes, while other reports indicate that only 2% of the deaths have been so-called high-value terrorist targets. So that would indicate something like 7 to 15 times as many civilians killed as high-level terrorist targets. So, and this is a policy where, you know, the limited U.S. government talking about it saying, you know, this is narrowly focused on high-level terrorist targets. Well, that's not the reality that is showing up in these independent reports. So, again, I don't think this would be – there's if you look at the independent reports, what the impression you would get is a policy that has a very cavalier attitude towards civilian deaths. And I don't think this would be possible if the, you know, the stories of what's happening to civilians were reaching the American people. And part of the reason that they're not is the refusal of the government to talk about the program. So I think the first thing would be to open up this program to public scrutiny. Let's have a real debate about who's being killed in these drone strikes. And, you know, let that be reported in the media so that Americans can be talking about the program that it actually exists rather than the story that's being told about it. And I think that would allow, you know, many Americans are ready to accept the idea that, you know, we're going to go after these high-level terrorist leaders. But the debate that, you know, we need to have is, well, okay, but what about killing 7 to 15 times as many civilians? What about those reports that the U.S. is targeting rescuers with these drone strikes? What about, you know, the secondary strikes where they go back and hit the same target again after other people gather at the strike? We don't know who these people are in the crowd that gathers. What about the signature strikes where they're hitting people that we don't even know they're hitting? So this is a debate that hasn't happened yet. I think if that debate happened, we could have a different policy. We could begin to have a very different policy.
Well, I thank you so much for the insight and the global perspective, and congratulate you on your recent trip to Pakistan on behalf of the end of the use of drones, and recommend that our listeners follow your good work at justforeignpolicy.org. Robert Naiman, thank you once again for a great analysis.
Good to be with you.
My name is Robert Knight, and this is WBAI's and Pacifica's special coverage of the presidential debate earlier this evening. We'll be back with more right after this.
Children killed in their sleep again. They're believed to be linked to Al Qaeda. Cluster bombed in their homes, but then they're believed to be linked to Al Qaeda. Believed to be linked to Al Qaeda. If you careful their humanity, we'll inundate you with profanity. If you question this insanity, you're believed to be linked to Al-Qaeda. Believed to be linked to Al-Qaeda. Are we asleep? Are we stupid? How long will we take their lives? Was the greatest form of terrorism? How many more kids have to from two planes, they said it's believed to be linked to Al Qaeda. Bush read a book to kids instead. He's believed to be linked to Al Qaeda. Believed to be linked to Al Qaeda. A bearded man in Afghanistan carried out his little master plan. Conspiracy on the news. Believed to be linked to Al Qaeda. Are we asleep? Are we stupid? How long will we take their lives? Was the greatest form of terrorism? How many more kills? How many more kills?
This is WBAI Pacifica coverage of the presidential debate. My name is Robert Knight. Thanks to our guests tonight, John Glazer of antiwar.com, Glenn Ford of blackagendareport.com, Alice Slater of abolish2000.org, and Robert Naiman of justforeignpolicy.org. And to recap for those joining us at this time of the day, basically it was a debate that by a huge consensus of our contributors that events no significant differences on foreign policy between the Democrat and the Republican. Both supported drone strikes. Both did not want to directly place human American troop bodies in the targeted nations that have resources that are of interest for regime change and petroleum contracts. Both endorsed extrajudicial assassinations. They both tilted heavily into the favor of Israel and with enmity towards the nation of Iran, which is by all reports engaged in a nuclear energy civilian program that, according to the United Nations mandated International Atomic Energy Agency, is to this point in time in compliance. Little noted nor not discussed was the Israeli nuclear arsenal of 200 to 300 atomic bombs that could also be brought into play in the event that frustration mounts over the mountain-hardened facility in Fodor for the continuing development of what the candidates did not distinguish. They kept saying Iran's nuclear program, but it is legal to have a civilian nuclear power program. There were some trivial differences over keeping troops in Iraq. Romney said he wanted them to be there explicitly. Obama is keeping them there as trainers and privatizing through various contract companies that are continuing the work, and there are remaining American bases inside Iraq. The discussion on Libya was nonsensical without an analysis of the creation of a state of chaos in the securing of new oil contracts from that country, a mission upon which the ambassador J. Christopher Stevens was engaged in Benghazi at the time of the September 11th attack. There was back and forth about that, but no systemic analysis on the effects of these wars on the American budget and on the continent of Africa and on the future, the next half of the 21st century. And that's just a brief summary of some of the things that came up. My name is Robert Knight. I am the anchor of 5 o'clock Shadow, and we welcome your comments, assessments, analysis, and suggestions. Please email us at theshadow@wbai.org. Thank you for listening tonight.
No one likes us. I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them. Asia's crowded, Europe's too old, Africa's far too hot and Canada's too cold, South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one, there'll be no one left to blame us. We'll save Australia, don't wanna hurt no kangaroo. We're building all American amusement park there. They got surfing too. Boom goes London, boom Paris. More room for you and more room for me. In every city, the whole world round, will just be another American town. Oh, how peaceful it will be. We'll set everybody free. Wear a Japanese kimono, baby, be Italian shoes for me. They all hate us anyhow. So let's drop the big one now. Let's drop the big one.